It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Most jails and prisons are designed to keep people close together in small spaces. The same conditions that keep them confined can also help diseases like coronavirus spread. Now, activists, prison reformers, and progressive prosecutors are calling on Pennsylvania leaders to release inmates faster, to make it more possible to socially distance those still behind bars. Joseph Darius Jafari is a staff writer for the PA Post who's been covering this issue. Joseph, can you give us an idea of the layout of many of these prisons? Why is it so difficult to implement proper social distancing?
Sure. So one of the things is really just the fact that the cells are placed really close to each other. And unfortunately, we don't have any kind of specific layouts of what a prison or a jail looks like because of security issues. States and counties won't release that. So we have to rely on what a lot of inmates and inmate family members and advocates and even sometimes corrections officers kind of tell us. And that is that, you know, these inmate cells, they're double bunked up. And so that means it's a tiny, tiny space where you have two people who can't socially distance themselves from each other. But then also the way that the cells are connected through ventilation systems, there's no fresh air kind of coming in. They're just kind of they're breathing in the same air as everybody else. I guess you could put it that way.
And are they sharing, shall I say, germs that way as well?
Well, so the way that prisoners talk to each other from cell to cell is through the vents in a lot of different cases. And so they'll put their mouth to the vent and they'll yell to the cellie next to them, right? Or the cell next to them and the cellies inside. And that is a vector for how this virus spreads. And so we can't obviously pinpoint to how the virus is spreading so fast within prisons, but it wouldn't be shocking if we were able to kind of do that kind of analysis to see exactly if the virus is spreading in that specific way.
Many facilities have gone into lockdown to try and contain the disease. So what are the conditions like for the inmates then?
Inmates are basically being told you are staying within your cell for 23 hours a day, sometimes 24 hours a day. But ultimately what it is that you are stuck in this cell with one other person for 22 hours minimum a day. And a lot of times they're not allowed out of it. You know, they get that 1 hour, those 2 hours to make phone calls and to take a shower and, you know, to do all the things they need to do. That's not a lot of time. And so what we're seeing and what we're hearing from inmates inside is that they're really bumping heads. Kind of like if you could imagine you and your partner are stuck in a bathroom for 22 hours a day with, you know, no Netflix, no Amazon. It's just you and maybe writing or reading.
What have you heard from the inmates and their families regarding the situation? Are they afraid?
You know, they've confirmed that some of the inmates that are inside have health issues such as, you know, sickle cell anemia, all these different, you know, diabetes, these underlying health conditions that absolutely would harm somebody if they were to catch coronavirus. And they showed symptoms. They are afraid. You know, one person that we spoke to, he's in there for a parole violation. And it's crazy to think that a parole violation would result in something like a death sentence for him when he has a compromised immune system with his medical condition.
Last week, the Department of Corrections acknowledged that it would have to release 10,000 inmates to be compliant with CDC guidelines for social distancing. Who would the state be releasing? What type of offenses?
So the governor said last couple weeks ago that he was going to try to release 1,800 prisoners, which, as you noted, it's far below the 10,000 needed to properly social distance. And of those people that he's offered to release, are people who are elderly, who are medically vulnerable, who have nonviolent offenses, and who are close to their release date. But even the people who were looking to release of that long list of who actually qualifies to be released, only about 40 to 80% of those people are likely to get released. So on the low end, we're seeing maybe 720 people being released.
Does everybody agree, though, that the release is a good idea?
No. I mean, there are plenty of people on the other side of this who, you know, have legitimate, you know, public health concerns and public safety concerns. One of the things we're hearing is that, if, you know, prisons are a vector for this virus because it's been known to spread so easily within. So are you letting people out who have, you know, the virus if they're asymptomatic? Because the only thing that the prison does is check their temperature when they leave and ask them a questionnaire. They don't do a kind of COVID test on any of them.
Say everybody agreed, all eligible inmates were released. if that would happen, would it create enough space to protect those who are still inside the prisons?
We don't have what we need to kind of make that assessment. And I don't think any activist or any prison rights group would argue that that is indefinitely a yes. Because the truth of the matter is that the way that prisons are built, it's kind of like being in a gym. You know, unless you are constantly wiping everything down all the time, you know, there's really only a few places where people go. And unless we are consistently keeping those places clean, there's really no way to say if, even if reducing the prison population, that it will keep, you know, coronavirus from spreading. All we can do is kind of go off of best guesses of what the experts and the public health experts are saying on this.
Joseph Darius Jafari reports for PA Post. Joseph, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. IT workers are not always treated kindly. In pop culture, they're often portrayed as awkward or obnoxious.
What? Well,
it's
which?
It's above the toolbar.
Okay, which toolbar?
Move!
But as Keystone Crossroads' Laura Benshoff reports, as massive amounts of public life move online, back-end computer gurus have been pushed into the spotlight in this moment, rising up to keep businesses virtually viable.
Spring is normally a very profitable time of year for Greensgrow, an urban garden and farm center in Philadelphia. Executive Director Meg DeBrito says it's also a very hands-on time.
Most people like to come in and look around and just sort of like take in the spring feeling.
But coronavirus has put the kibosh on plant touching and flower smelling at the farm this year. They also didn't hire their normal seasonal workers. But e-commerce has become more important than ever. DeBrito taught herself how to build out the company's online sales portal, but when she needs help, she leans on a tech firm.
We have a really great small IT company that has been willing to kind of like flex with us and plug in where they can when we need help.
Stories like this one show how some tech workers may be insulated from coronavirus layoffs. More than 1.3 million Pennsylvanians have lost work and applied for unemployment in the last month. But tech workers were in the job category with the lowest number of claims, and some have been in overdrive.
It was 24/7.
That's John Marconti, Chief Information Officer for Vanguard, the financial services company headquartered in the Philly suburbs. He says it took three shifts working day and night to allow 14,000 of the company's employees to work from home. Part of that was setting up distribution points for the monitors and other tools advisors need to keep an eye on financial markets and have confidential conversations with clients.
As you can think of traders, you know, having three or four monitors and activities going on, all that. How do you construct that environment at home?
With the economy in turmoil, Vanguard's employees have a lot to do remotely. But economists predict white-collar workers who've been spared layoffs so far may be hit in future rounds. Joseph Ruffin, who runs a tech company that supports malls and other large stores, has already seen his business suffer.
Over the last month, we've probably averaged about three calls a week that we've gone on, versus in the past, it would be three calls a day.
He's had to let go of employees and is now looking into contracts with local and federal government to try to make up some of the business he's lost.
On a positive side, we're still doing work for some essential businesses.
A military veteran, Ruffin says he feels called to help essential businesses, grocery stores, pharmacies, that are still open in any way he can.
It feels really good to be able to help.
In some cases, companies roiled by layoffs have held on to IT workers, making them some of the last folks standing and filling the void. Mark Morrison is vice president of IT for the Greater Philadelphia YMCA, which laid off 4,000 people in March.
Oh, it's very painful. I've always viewed the staff of the YMCA as my first customer. By serving what they need, then they can go in turn and serve the community. Now we're just turning around saying, okay, we're now going to do their work.
He also lost half of his team. Those who are left are working sometimes 12-hour days, setting up call centers, trying to work with members who can no longer come to the gym. Like many other businesses, the Y is using video conferencing software in ways it never expected.
For any of you that don't know me, my name is Pam.
Instructors at local Ys are now doing classes on Zoom.
And I've been teaching at the Rocky Run YMCA for, I believe, 12 years at least.
From her home, Pam Daimler guides dozens of seniors through a program called Senior Strut. It's one part gentle workout.
Circle your arms the other way, thumbs back.
One part socializing.
Linda,
how did you
like it?
I loved it.
These virtual spaces provide opportunities for connection and a break from isolation.
We're not allowed out. We're confined to our apartments, and we'll get through it.
You will. And you'll come take my class every day I do it,
right? I will.
And you can thank tech workers for some of that. Laura Benchoff, Keystone Crossroads.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Invasives are things that we generally want to block out. Invasive vines, bugs, weeds, critters that swim in our rivers and streams, and alternative ecosystems. Climate change has forced some scientists to change their minds about the negative impacts of some invasive plants, but not everyone is on board. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on how a common reed known as Phragmites is at the center of this debate.
We've all seen Phragmites, either driving along I-95 or maybe on our way down the shore.
It's a plant that can be about 18 feet tall. It's a reed, basically. Common name is common reed.
In the winter, the plant is tan-colored, topped with a feathery seed pod that makes them look like giant paintbrushes or brooms. In the summer, the stems are green, and the brushes have a purplish sheen.
It spreads very quickly.
Lamar Gore is the manager at the John Hines National Wildlife Refuge in Southwest Philadelphia. A big part of his job is battling invasive Phragmites, trying to prevent them from taking over the wetlands at the refuge. They're too dense to walk through, even for deer. In fact, phrag comes from the Greek word for fence.
Yes, nice to see you. Did you come for the harvest?
On a winter day at the Hines Refuge, a group of volunteers works to clear a swath of Phragmites.
Kyle, coming in.
I have a white jacket on, everyone. Just to let you know, I have a white jacket on.
Gore says killing Phragmites in the remaining wetlands along the mid-Atlantic coast is an unending job.
A lot of the wetlands on the refuge are slowly being overtaken by the Phragmites. And so that takes away foraging habitat for wildlife. It also takes away some of the area where shorebirds like to feed.
There is a native Phragmites plant, but the much more aggressive, invasive subspecies originated in the Middle East, where it's used to make baskets and huts. These invasive Phragmites probably came to the U.S. in the ballast water of a ship. The first official record of non-native Phragmites in America was found in the port of Camden in 1876. About 65 miles south of the John Hines National Wildlife Refuge, on a cold, rainy day, Todd Fritchman points to a stand of Phragmites surrounding the town of Leipsic, Delaware, on the shores of the Delaware Bay.
This can be found all along the eastern seaboard from here all the way up to New York City.
As the rain splashes against our umbrellas, Fritchman explains how insidious these invasive Phragmites are. They send chemicals into the ground that poison and prevent other plants from growing near them, wiping out food sources for native birds.
Nothing eats these seeds.
Fritchman is an aquatic biologist. He sells motors and mechanical parts, and he's the captain of the Dewey Beach Patrol. He also owns an ecological services business that kills Phragmites.
So this is an area, a high marsh area, or a maritime forest area, where we should have shrub species such as high tide bush, southern bayberry.
Instead, what you see is a monoculture of densely packed reeds that create a fire hazard and look ugly to Fritchman.
In order to get rid of the plant, to control and eradicate it, you have to kill the rhizome system underground or it will always regenerate new stems.
The rhizomes are underground stems that grow horizontally and send up shoots. They're huge. They run about 4 feet below the surface and could be 10 inches in diameter. But those same stubborn, dense rhizomes are what some scientists say could help preserve marshes from impending sea level rise. Marine biologist Judith Weiss studied Phragmites for decades.
Now, 20 years ago, sea level rise was something we were thinking about as basically a future thing. Today, it's clearly with us and happening faster and faster all the time.
She says that tangle of thick, dense plant matter traps sediment really well, which helps the marsh rise in elevation. And she says Phragmites have another benefit. They clean pollutants from the water better than native species.
I'm not saying never remove it anywhere. I'm not saying go out and plant it. I'm saying there should be better ways to restore marshes, keeping sea level rise in mind, because sea level rise is, may I say, an existential issue facing our marshes, and it may be a matter of survival or not.
Coastal wetlands in the mid-Atlantic are squeezed between the ocean and development.
So they're either going to have to elevate or drown.
Weiss says the new research showing the benefits of Phragmites is ignored by marsh managers.
There's a whole army of environmental consultants that get paid to remove Phragmites and don't get paid to leave it alone.
Delaware has spent hundreds of thousands of state and federal dollars trying to clear Phragmites from coastal wetlands. And that's a lot of Roundup. 50% of Todd Fritchman's eco-services business is controlling invasive Phragmites.
Yeah, its control and eradication is condoned pretty much by every regulatory agency that exists.
And you don't think that's going to change because of climate change or sea level rise?
That's not going to change. Yeah, that will not change.
But Judith Weiss says change is needed in how we think about invasives.
Living things aren't good or evil. They are doing a variety of things, some of which we like and some of which we don't. So we can't be viewing living things as good or evil, but merely as living things and how do they fit into what we are wanting there.
And while Phragmites do not provide food for a lot of migrating songbirds, a few birds like hanging out and nesting in the densely packed reeds. And this red-winged blackbird likes to nest there so much, he's warning me to back off. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
And for today, that is The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Joya Zenkovich, Kylie Kozinski, and Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Please be safe, and I hope you have a good day of good news.